From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! As militias continue to fire on the capital in Dili, East Timor, Democracy Now! Asks the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations if he would support the imposition of an arms embargo on Indonesia. Also, as George W. Bush's campaign coffers increase, so do questions about his drug use. And a look at police killings in Jamaica, the highest in the Caribbean. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. congressional staffers toured the port of Basra, Iraq's second largest city today, as part of a fact-finding mission on the impact of U.N. sanctions. The staff members were scheduled to visit a hospital and a school and receive a briefing from officials of the southern city before starting the 345-mile drive north to Baghdad. The Americans are in Iraq to examine the impact of the trade embargo imposed following Iraq's 1990 invasion of Kuwait. Their tour has been arranged with the help of the Chicago-based activist group Voices in the Wilderness, which has defied U.S. restrictions to bring thousands of dollars worth of medicines to Iraq. There are new developments regarding the 1993 standoff and subsequent fire at the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas. Both the Dallas Morning News and the New York Times report that infrared FBI tapes reveal the voice of an agent asking for and receiving permission to fire incendiary tear gas grenades at a bunker next to the compound. U.S. Marshals took the tapes yesterday from FBI headquarters in Washington. Meanwhile, the Times and Washington Post report Attorney General Janet Reno has decided upon an independent inquiry on the issue. A federal appeals court has upheld a decision allowing the Million Youth March to go forward in Harlem this weekend, even going so far as to warn New York City not to police the rally with, quote, undue rigidity. Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, who insists the event is a thinly disguised hate march, was furious with the ruling, saying the judges, quote, have the luxury of keeping their heads in the sand. Rally organizers said the event, which they estimate will draw 20,000 people, will focus on opportunities for Black and Latino youth to make a better world by educating themselves and challenging their government to act fairly and responsibly to everyone. This news from Santa Fe, New Mexico, a fiery uprising by 290 prisoners that led to the killing of a corrections guard at a private prison has sparked renewed criticism of the facilities in New Mexico. Ralph Garcia was the first prison guard killed in a dozen years in New Mexico, but in the past 9 months, four prisoners have been killed in prisons operated by Wackenhut Corrections Corporation. Republican Governor Gary Johnson and Corrections Secretary Rob Perry said they haven't decided whether to follow through on Perry's threat to remove prisoners from private prisons if more deaths or disturbances occur. This news from Beijing, while declaring its resolve to retake rival Taiwan by force if necessary, China removed one threat today by promising not to use nuclear weapons in the event of a conflict. The pledge, issued by the foreign ministry, was the most explicit public renunciation of the nuclear option China has ever given Taiwan and suggested a slight easing of their latest tensions. Iran's supreme leader said yesterday that anyone who questioned the Islamic rationale for the death penalty deserved to be executed, this according to Tehran Radio. His remark came a week after a reformist newspaper called for capital punishment to be abolished in Iran. Last week, the outspoken newspaper Neshat published an article calling for the abolition of capital punishment. The article said capital punishment was the most prominent type of governmental violence. This news from Jerusalem, an American teenager who fled to Israel to avoid murder charges has admitted his guilt in an Israeli court. In a plea bargain, Samuel Sheinbin pleaded guilty to strangling an acquaintance in Maryland in 1997. If an Israeli judge approves the deal, Sheinbin would serve up to 24 years in an Israeli prison, but he could be eligible for early release after 16 years. U.S. prosecutors are angry with the deal, saying it's too lenient. Republican presidential candidate George W. Bush, decrying federal education policies that, quote, cheat poor children, says his administration would require states to test disadvantaged students, strip federal funds from the worst-scoring schools, and allow private schools to get the public money. In a back-to-school address laying out his first education proposals of the 2000 campaign, Bush says federal money withheld from schools that repeatedly fail state testing standards would follow students to better public schools, charter schools, tutoring, or, quote, whatever option parents choose, including private schools. Though aides said Bush intentionally avoided the politically charged term school vouchers, his proposal would in fact pump federal money into private schools, a concept Democrats say would hurt the public school system. And that's some of the news. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we have been doing for the last few days now, we go first to Dili, East Timor. Yesterday, the United Nations Security Council held a private meeting to discuss the situation of the violence in East Timor. As we reported yesterday morning, militias sponsored by the Indonesian regime laid siege to the UN compound in Dili, East Timor. It looks like two people have died so far as a result of that. It was serious business at the United Nations yesterday as the Security Council met. And after a few hours, the new president of the Security Council, it switches at the first of every month. It was Namibia. Now the president of the Netherlands ambassador is the president of the Security Council, came out and made this statement.
Council members welcomed the smooth conduct of the popular consultation on the 30th of August. They condemned, however, in the strongest terms, the violence in Dili that has taken place since. They underlined the need for the popular consultation process and its follow-up to be completed in an atmosphere of peace and security without further violence. They demanded that the local authorities in East Timor take steps to arrest those responsible for the violence and bring them to justice. They demanded also that the Indonesian government take immediate steps to prevent the recurrence of such incidents in the future, in compliance with the responsibilities for its responsibility for maintaining peace and security as set out in the 5th of May agreement, and that it guarantee the security of UNAMED personnel and premises. That is the statement.
A reporter then asked about the possibility of a UN peacekeeping force being moved in, the UN Security Council president.
No, I would be dishonest if I would say that the word wasn't mentioned, but we decided not to go into that.
Just before the UN Security Council president, the ambassador from the Netherlands read that statement, I caught up with the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, who will just be that for a few more days now. He is Peter Burley.
Ambassador Burley, would the U.S. recommend an arms embargo against Indonesia, given the violence that they're sponsoring in East Timor right now?
I wouldn't have any comment on that. We're looking for the Indonesians to live up to their responsibilities in East Timor under the May 5 agreement, and we expect they will. We've had reassurances of this again.
Has the U.S. pushed for a condemnation of the Indonesian-sponsored violence?
What do you mean?
A resolution, a Security Council resolution, as opposed to just a press statement.
No.
Why not?
There's a State Department announcement, our position, that was just issued at 1 o'clock. You might want to refer to that.
Why not support a Security Council resolution?
Because we want to see this process continue as smoothly as possible in East Timor to its logical conclusion. And to do that, there has to be the enthusiastic cooperation of the government of Indonesia. They play a critical role in this entire process, and we're counting on them to live up to their agreement and their responsibility. That's all.
That's the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Peter Burley. I also got a chance to ask the British Ambassador to the United Nations about the situation.
This didn't even condemn the Indonesian government for the violence. It just says condemning violence.
Correct.
Why not condemn the Indonesian government for the violence?
Because they weren't responsible for the violence. The militia were mainly responsible for the violence, and that violence has been condemned because we want to encourage the Indonesians to take their full responsibility for the security situation, and that means continuing the relationship with the Indonesian government.
Are you saying that it's not believed that Indonesian regime is behind the militia violence?
I don't think there was a political decision to support that violence, no.
That was the British ambassador to the United Nations yesterday, following Peter Burley, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., after the U.N. Security Council met privately to discuss the issue of the violence in East Timor. We now go directly to the territory, to Dili, the capital, where journalist Alan Nairn is standing by. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Alan.
Thanks.
Well, can you respond to the UN Security Council yesterday just issuing a press statement, which is less than a presidential statement of the UN Security Council and certainly less than a Security Council resolution condemning the violence in East Timor? And then the response of the U.S. ambassador on the issue of would they ever sponsor a push for arms embargo against Indonesia, and the British ambassador saying that he doesn't think that the Indonesian regime is behind the militia violence.
Well, the Security Council is basically at the mercy of the U.S. and Britain, which are the two principal military sponsors of the Indonesian army. Right now, Britain has just completed the shipment of Hawk fighter planes into Indonesia. Those planes were used recently to buzz Dili and to buzz the Timor countryside, causing great fear among the population. The U.S., the number one backer of the Indonesian military, has basically supplied the rest of the Air Force, the F-16s, the A-4s, the OV-10 Broncos that they use to drop napalm and bomb people down from the hills during the height of the genocide. And even today, after the cutbacks imposed by the public and Congress, the U.S. is still shipping in ammunition and weapons, even as it condemns the terror. And since the U.S. and Britain have veto power, the rest of the Security Council in this case is pretty much at their mercy. One of the officials made a call, or the statement made a call, to arrest those responsible for the violence and bring them to justice. If they really mean that, they would be calling on the local police, the local Indonesian occupation police in Timor, to fly to Jakarta and arrest General Wiranto, who is their commander-in-chief. That's not likely. They also call on the Indonesian government to prevent a recurrence of violence in the territory. The implication is, and the way a lot of the press covers it, is that that would mean they'd start enforcing the laws. But it gets very twisted when you think about it, because they're the perpetrators. And what are they supposed to do? Are they supposed to arrest themselves? The most outrageous statement was that from the British ambassador, where he said the Indonesian military was not responsible for the violence. The militias were responsible for the violence. Well, every serious observer on the ground in Timor, including all of the UN people I've spoken to, and this includes U.S. and Australian and other military advisors, all state the obvious that the Indonesian military runs the militias. What he said, what the British ambassador said, is kind of like saying, I wasn't responsible for the killing. It was my hand that pulled the trigger. So don't blame me. It was my hand that did it.
Alan, what do you think the UN could do most effectively right now to stop the violence?
Well, what the UN could do, but which is politically impossible because of the role that the U.S. and the other Western powers hold in the UN, would be to condemn the Indonesian government for supporting the terror in Timor, and to condemn the U.S. and Britain and Australia and the others for supporting the Indonesian government militarily. That would be the most effective action, and they could threaten something like the arms embargoes that the U.S. has occasionally imposed against governments. That would be the most logical solution to the problem, but they can't do that politically. Instead, what's happening right now in Timor is that the reports today are that thousands of new police and Indonesian military will be brought in, ostensibly to control the militia violence. As a friend here said, that's like calling in the fire brigade to put out the fire using gasoline instead of water. They're the perpetrators. They're not the enforcers.
What has happened in the last day since we spoke 24 hours ago? At that time, militias had laid siege to the UN compound. You had been there and then gone to the Motayal clinic where a young man died who'd been killed by the militias. What's happened since then?
Well, the militia attacks have continued today. They were the Aitarak militia, which is based right across the street at the old Tropical Hotel from an Indonesian military base. They were up in the hills over the neighborhood of Bakora and were firing down into the market area. And some Aitarak also reportedly went into the Turismo Hotel where a lot of journalists stay, and they were strutting around with weapons and threatening the journalists. And that's just what I happen to know of what happened in Dili today. It's quite likely that much more was going on out in the countryside. Just tonight, I got a very extremely well-documented report of plans that were made a couple of days ago by Kopassus and a local militia in one rural area to stage an attack on some foreign observers. The attack didn't come off because, as it happened, the observers change their logistical plans, but that's the way it is in the rural areas, and of course it's much worse for the Timorese than the foreigners. In fact, yesterday, one Australian delegation visitor said that it appears that the number of Timorese refugees, which was earlier put at 60,000 refugees from the militia violence, has probably increased in recent days.
Finally, we have Newswire reports that thousands of Timorese are trying to flee East Timor. Is that the case?
That's not clear. If thousands of Timorese are really trying to flee, I actually doubt that. What is happening, though, is that the Indonesian government is flying in military planes to fly out at least many hundreds of Indonesian professionals and civil servants who've been manning the infrastructure for the occupation in Timor. That's consistent with the plans that Jakarta has for a ballot defeat, plans that were laid out in a confidential memo, leaked confidential memo from the office of General Faisal Tanjung. He's the politics and security minister. He has the job of whipping the various civilian ministries in Indonesia into line with army policy. And they talked about a mass evacuation of Timor, which would involve them stripping all Indonesian assets from the territory. They had earlier talked about things like shutting down banks, removing generators, removing electric wires, things like that, and also even destroying installations on their way out of Timor. That's what the Tanjung memo talked about. And the evacuation now of Indonesian personnel on planes could be the beginning of that kind of move. Dr. Dan Murphy, the American doctor who was serving the Timorese here until he was thrown out by the occupation forces, has expressed great concern about that, saying that there's already this terrible shortage of doctors and medical care in Timor, And if the few Indonesian civilian doctors who are here are now pulled out, the situation will get even worse. There were some Timorese, as we talked about yesterday, who were prevented the day before yesterday from leaving at the airport. And in today's Jakarta Post, there's this remarkable quote from an Indonesian police official. His name is Captain Widodo Diaz, and he says, this is in the context of a discussion of the ITARIC's blocking Timorese from leaving and other ITARIC's attacks. He says, according to the Post, the militia movement is understandable and conducted under police supervision. They just want everybody to remain in East Timor so they can share in the burden of finding a settlement to their internal matters. And he also added, but we have persuaded them not to act excessively. So here's the police official acknowledging that the militias are acting under police supervision and that they have already brought them to a level of terror that, in the police view, is not excessive.
Alan Nairn speaking to us from Dili, East Timor, and this few days after the historic referendum that took place on August 30th, 99% of the Timorese population came out to vote on whether their country should become independent. We'll continue to bring these daily updates from the island that has been occupied by Indonesia for the last 24 years under its rule. 200,000 Timorese, a third of the population, has died. You are listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back from our break, we'll take a look at George Bush and drugs. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. The 100th person to be executed in Texas under George W. Bush died last night at 6 p.m. in the Walls Unit of Huntsville. Raymond Jones said he had no last words as he was injected with a lethal combination of drugs. Bush, who's capitalized politically on his tough-on-crime stance, has broken all records for a number of executions under any governor in the history of the United States. Meanwhile, as his war chest reaches the $50 million mark, questions about his possible past drug use continue to follow the Texas governor and presidential candidate. Civil rights leader Jesse Jackson recently added his voice to that of others, calling for a straight answer from Bush, saying that, quote, the laws against illicit narcotics is public policy that he enforces. You cannot enforce a law that you don't adhere to. George W. Bush has presided over a growing prison population in Texas, in part due to legislation already in place when he became governor, and in part because he's continued to expand those policies. Many of those being imprisoned in Texas have been convicted of drug offenses. Under his watch, there's been a steady rise in the incarceration of both adults and juveniles. A Bush law lowered the age that a juvenile can be tried and imprisoned as an adult to 14. On the question of whether he ever used cocaine or any other illegal drug, George W. Bush gave a limited answer last week, saying he had not used any since at least 1974, the year he turned 28. In a recent interview with a New Hampshire television station, George W. Bush's mother, Barbara Bush, said this week she and her husband never asked their son if he has used cocaine. She said, "We had no need to." While George W. Bush continues to insist he won't buckle to what he calls politics of personal destruction by the press and his political foes, The pressure for the complete truth grows even from Republicans. Conservative William Bennett recently recalled that when he first met George W. after his father, then President Bush, had made Bennett the nation's anti-drug czar, the younger Bush's advice at the time was kick butt. But Bennett recently wrote an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal headlined Answer the Question. Well, today we're going to continue our conversation about the issue of George W. Bush's possible drug use and what it means, should we know it, and how people are responding around the country. We're joined by Eric Sterling, president of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation. He's also the former counsel of the chairman of the House Subcommittee on Crime. He wrote the mandatory minimum sentencing legislation, which he regrets having done very much right now. Eric Sterling, welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello, Amy.
Hi. Well, each day, there's another small step made toward finding out a little more about George Bush's history when it comes to drugs. Again, at this point, we don't know whether he used drugs, illegal drugs like cocaine and heroin. He's now said that he didn't since the age of 28, but hasn't gone further than that. What are you thinking now as a person who deals specifically with drug laws in this country?
The question, it raises so many very interesting questions. I mean, at one level, you can sort of be like Barbara Brush, does it matter? Who cares? This was long ago and in the past. But as soon as you think that, you then have to think about the hundreds of thousands of people who were arrested for conduct which we infer that George W. Bush engaged in, who were convicted, were sent to prison, and who are never going to have the option of running for president of the United States or even president of a company. They will be forever handicapped in their ability to get credit, hold positions of responsibility. Even if they are young today, they would be unable to get federal assistance for loans for college if they have a conviction for a drug offense. So at one level, there's this sense of the tremendous double standard and the privilege that George Bush had if he was indeed a drug user. A second issue then is George Bush as governor. How has he dealt with people who were in the same kind of situation that we infer that he was in 25 or 30 years ago? And by changing laws that send simple possessors to prison, one has to wonder whether or not he is a tremendous hypocrite. A law that he signed meant that for persons who possess less than a gram of cocaine, which is not a very large amount at all, they're eligible to go to prison for up to 2 years and a sentence of probation for 5 years. And that in those cases, very commonly, people will get sentenced to at least 30 days in jail, and they will, of course, end up with a felony conviction, which means they couldn't vote. We're in the kind of ironic situation that had George Bush been captured and prosecuted and convicted, while he could run for president, he couldn't vote for himself in the election. The one consequence is there is a tremendous class and race bias in the justice system. In Texas, for example, now, of those felons in what are called the state jails set up for largely drug offenders, such as people like the young George W. Bush, 58% of them are black, 17%, and less than 1 in 4 are white in a state that is a dominantly white state. And this kind of race discrimination is typical of all the drug enforcement across the country.
We're talking to Eric Sterling, who does not like to be known for the fact that he is the person who actually wrote the mandatory minimum sentencing legislation that was put through by Congress. But in fact, he did it, and did it as the former counsel to the Democratic chair of the House Subcommittee on Crime.
Yeah, these mandatory minimums at the federal level are a profound scandal, and you know, this is something that a George W. Bush as candidate for president of the United States ought to address squarely. Congress thought that these laws were going to be used against the highest level traffickers. In fact, the Sentencing Commission shows that only about 11% of all federal drug offenders are high level traffickers. In 1998, the federal government sent 20,000 people to prison for drug offenses. Only 41 of them went under the Kingpin statute. Two-thirds of them didn't even qualify for the 10-year mandatory minimum, which is triggered by very small quantities of drugs, such as 50 grams of crack cocaine. I think that if I were George W. Bush looking seriously at our anti-drug policies, I would, you know, be outraged and would be challenging them.
Eric Sterling, we're also joined on the telephone by Sean Heller, who's president of Students for Sensible Drug Policy, and he's a student at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Now, Sean, Eric just referred to a law that says that students lose student aid if they're caught with drugs. Can you explain what that's about?
Yes. In 1998, the Republican Congress proved their continued reliance on punitive measures by including a provision in the Higher Education Act which denies or delays federal financial aid to any college students with previous drug offenses, including petty possession. Now, the impact that this will have is that, you know, you have your poorer people who are more often caught for their use of drugs, obviously not like G.W. Bush, and they are then instructed to, you know, take parole or probation and and by their court-appointed attorneys. Now, at this point, they are no longer eligible for federal financial aid. And these are the students who definitely need the financial aid and are not being given the aid and are getting their education denied. Now, in an advanced society, we must look to education as a solution, not a privilege that can be taken away at the will of the establishment.
You know, it's important to point out, as you did, that we're not talking about a law applying equally to people, you know, around the country. We're talking about clearly poorer kids being affected by this. It's not that, you know, all people who lose drugs would lose access to higher education. It's that kids who need financial aid would lose that access.
Yes. Only students who are eligible for financial aid would then be the ones that this would affect, because if one would have the money to go to school initially, they wouldn't be applying for financial aid and wouldn't run into this problem.
Something, Amy, that's worth noting is that this only applies in drug cases. If you were...
Eric Sterling.
This is Eric. If you were charged and convicted with, let's say, rape or armed robbery or aggravated assault, you'd still be eligible for student aid. This is a perverse kind of anti-second chances approach toward the kind of offense that, in some sense, if George Bush, in fact, used cocaine, typifies the need for second chances. If people are involved in the use of drugs as young people, you know, very, very frequently they recognize that they're not going, that it's causing them problems, they stop doing it, and they go on to lead constructive lives. This is sort of, this law that Sean is describing is designed to prevent second chances. It's designed to prevent rehabilitation. It's designed to have much more profound social consequences than simply trying to deal with the drug problem. The rationale is somehow that this law will deter people from experimenting with drugs, but it's a preposterous assumption. There's no evidence that these laws, which have been so extensively enforced, 1.5 million people being arrested last year for these crimes, that the very threat of criminal law itself is not stopping people. And so millions, tens of millions, for example, have been arrested for the marijuana law in the last 25 years.
Furthermore, many people, especially your poorer people, don't know that this law has been enacted and don't know that their drug use could lead to them losing their financial aid.
Hmm. We're talking to Adam Smith, who's director of the Drug Reform Coordination Network, We're going to him right now. Sean Heller on the line with us, president of Students for Sensible Drug Policy from George Washington University, and Eric Sterling, who's president of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation. Adam Smith, what do you think George W. Bush Jr. should do? I assume he's sitting with his top aides or people that he values their opinions each day to figure out exactly what he is going to say on this issue as it becomes bigger and bigger, and even his allies call for him to give a response.
Well, what I think he should do, and what I think he, what it would be nice to have seen him done from the beginning is, as Mr. Sterling pointed out, is to face squarely the problem that we're having with our drug policy in this country and the fact that we have a two-tier justice system. George Bush, you know, whether George Bush used cocaine or not, the idea that he did highlights the fact that people in George Bush's situation are rarely in any danger of running into trouble with the drug laws. The places we're enforcing are poor communities. The people we're enforcing against are overwhelmingly poor. There's sort of an understanding that there's lots of drugs, for instance, on Wall Street and being used by kids in very expensive schools, but those aren't the people who belong in the criminal justice system. The people who belong in the criminal justice system are people without the resources to keep themselves out of it. I think that that's a very profound moral question in this country. Is this really, do we really believe that people who use drugs need to have 10 or 15 or 20 years of their lives taken away? And nobody seems to believe that for George Bush. I was struck yesterday when Barbara Bush on a television interview pointed out that this was really nobody's business and this was irrelevant. And I couldn't help but think of the thousands and thousands of mothers who are sitting, you know, across the country whose children are gone for exactly the same behavior.
Well, Adam Smith, tell us what your group, the Drug Reform Coordination Network, this internet-based drug reform organization, is proposing right now.
What are we proposing? Well, we are primarily committed to public education around the issue of drug policy. We think it's very important that people stop and begin to understand what's going on, and toward that end, we produce a weekly news magazine that covers drug policy and efforts at reform, and we give people an opportunity through the internet to organize themselves, to speak out, to contact their elected officials regarding legislation. We believe that the more people who understand this issue, the faster politicians like George Bush and others will be forced to publicly confront the hypocrisy and the failure that really is our drug policy.
We also are interested in our listeners' thoughts right now. If you were to give a recommendation to George W. Bush about what he should do at this point, we'd like to hear from you, and we're going to play some of those comments on the air. Our comment line is 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. Eric Sterling, there could be two approaches George W. Bush would take around the issue of public policy. You know, his mother says you should evaluate him based on his public policy. And one would be to reform all the drug laws and to say, yes, we do need a second chance. And the other is to adopt an extremely rigid approach and a very punitive approach, which does seem to be the direction he's going. And then the question is how he's going to reconcile that with the time when he makes, if he does, his own admissions.
The conservative columnist Arianna Huffington sort of posed this in the conclusion of a recent column of hers. She said it would be a truly defining moment if Bush were to use any personal confession he might make not only to express his regret, but to decry our present drug policy that makes second chances and learning from one's mistakes nearly impossible. If he chooses instead to stand behind the zero tolerance of our $40 billion a year war on drugs, which is every day looking more and more like a domestic Vietnam, and continues to advocate harsh sentences for first-time nonviolent offenders, then he will expose himself as the worst kind of hypocrite, forfeiting any claim of moral superiority over the man he seeks to succeed. I think that she captures very well the predicament that Bush is in. The temptation of politicians is to be tough. It's like water running downhill. Having observed scores of elected public officials up close during my years working with the U.S. Congress. They love the rhetoric. They love the imagery of being tough, of cracking down. They love to stand on the well of the House or the Senate and commend one another for their courage in bringing amendments which are going to pass 99-0. It is, you know, if it is said that the last refuge of scoundrels is patriotism, well, today it is true that the last refuge of scoundrels is to be tough in the war on drugs.
We're going to continue this discussion just for a few more minutes after the break, and then we're going to go to a country which has the highest rate of police killings of civilians in the Caribbean, and that is Jamaica. We're talking to Eric Sterling, president of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation, Adam Smith, director of the Drug Reform Coordination Network, and Sean Heller, president of Students for Sensible Drug Policy. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue this discussion about drug use with the pending answer from George W. Bush Jr., the front runner for the Republican nomination for president, he's raised $50 million. Clearly, a lot of eggs being put in one basket here. And yet it is admitted by almost everyone that this waiting answer has, you know, at some point is going to come out. And the question is, what is it going to mean? And will it affect public policy? Will it change Republicans and Democrats' views? There's a group called Families Against Mandatory Minimums that has put out information on various high-level politicians and issues they've had to deal with in their own families when a kid, for example, gets caught either selling drugs or using drugs. And often they're able to get out of it, unlike many poor Black and Latino youth in this country who can end up in jail for years. Our guest, Eric Sterling, who is the former counsel of the chair of the House Subcommittee on Crime. He wrote the mandatory minimum sentencing legislation. Adam Smith, director of the Drug Reform Coordination Network, and Sean Heller, president of Students for Sensible Drug Policy. He's a student at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Sean, often people equate those who promote drug reform with those who promote drug use. You're having a national conference in November on drug policy. What's it about?
Yes, November 5th and 6th, we're having a national conference entitled Student Leaders in Drug Policy and Justice. And you're right. Many people do have the misconception that those who are interested in drug policy reform are advocates of drug use, but we're not. In reality, what we stand for is looking at this issue not solely as a punitive issue. Other countries have taken steps in that direction, Switzerland instituting heroin maintenance, Australia attempting to do some other issues with harm reduction, that there are ways to solve drug problems without throwing, you know, huge amounts of your population in jail. We have one of the largest prison populations in the world. We have a population, African Americans constituting 13% of the population, 13% of drug users, and 55% of drug convictions. Now, these disproportionate numbers are quite, you know, are quite telling of the failures in our policy. And to date, we still don't have a drug-free high school in America, and we never will. We need to learn how to deal with these issues on a rational level rather than just saying we're making them illegal and we're going to throw people in jail for drug use.
Amy, the most disturbing thing is
Eric Sterling.
Is the failure of the society to provide drug treatment to people who are addicted. Drugs are, Barry McCaffrey calls our drug policy a failed social policy. He says we can't arrest our way out of it. His data in his 1999 strategy says that there are 3.3 million Americans who desperately need drug treatment who can't get it. And yet, only about $5 or $6 billion is spent on drug treatment, and something on the order of $35 to $40 billion is spent on imprisonment, investigations, military operations, border interdiction, and so on, none of which prevents drugs from getting to kids, getting to our streets. The price of heroin and cocaine today is lower than it's been at any time in our history. High school kids, when asked, is it easy to get heroin or cocaine, say it is easier in 1998 to get it than it's ever been since they've been asked that question since the early 1970s.
You know, it's interesting also talking about the issue of drug treatment. In an article in the Wall Street Journal on Monday, they write that under Ann Richards and the late Lieutenant Governor Bob Bullock, both recovering alcoholics, drug treatment in Texas prisons became a priority for the first time. The initial goal was to treat 14,000 of the new inmates. The number of spaces for drug treatment is now less than half of that early goal, but it had been whittled to about 5,800 by the time Bush took over. Cost is a big factor, but so is lack of counselors and facilities, according to one prison official. Also, just a comment on the Texas prisons. An interesting fact, 148,000 people in the state prisons, a system that would put Texas as the world's third largest, having the world's third largest prison population behind Russia and China. That's pretty astounding.
That's pretty shocking.
Hmm.
I would like to point out, if I could, that this isn't just about a policy that is being somewhat effective but is scooping up too many poor people or focusing in the wrong places. This is a policy that's actually creating grist for an enormous prison industry. You know, prohibition itself breeds the illicit markets that are then enforced that pull all these people into the prison system. The Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse came out with a poll this week. And they had asked students which is easier to get, and out of marijuana and beer, nine times as many 12 to 17-year-olds said it was easier to get marijuana than it was to get beer. We've set up a system where drugs are more available to young people in this country than they are to anyone else. And I believe if you ask the typical parent of a teenager in America if he or she could buy drugs, they would probably have to go ask their child.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. And I also want to ask the listeners to, share your response and what you think George W. Bush Jr. should do at this point in answering this question, whether he should. And then if you think he should, what do you think should follow from that? We've been talking to Adam Smith, director of the Drug Reform Coordination Network, an internet-based drug reform group. What's your website, Adam?
We have a number of them. The easiest one to remember is stopthedrugwar.org.
That's www.stopthedrugwar.org. Eric Sterling, president of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation of Washington, number?
And our website is at www.cjpf.org.
And Sean Heller, president of Students for Sensible Drug Policy at George Washington University. And if people want to get in touch with you, especially around the student conference this November on drug policy and reform, where can they call?
If interested about the conference or anything else we're doing, we could be reached at www.ssdp.org. And we could also be reached at 202-965-6257.
That's 202-965-6257. Well, thank you all very much for being with us. And again, if you want to call into our comment line, 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. Well, in this country, we've been dealing extensively with the issue of police brutality. Just this week, the Congressional Black Caucus held a hearing in Los Angeles dealing with that issue. And here in New York, there have been a number of police shootings. In the last 4 weeks, there have been five. In just the last few days, there have been two. Just a few days ago, a Hasidic man in Brooklyn was gunned down by police, a man who suffered from mental illness. And late yesterday, another man was killed as police say they were pulling him out of a livery cab. He was thought to have evaded a taxi fare, and he was shot dead. And there were protests in the largely Dominican community of Harlem at 137th Street in that community. But right now we're going to turn to another country, and that is Jamaica. The high level of police killings in the island nation of Jamaica is attracting the attention of international human rights groups. According to the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights and Labor, local police have averaged between 130 and 140 killings per year over the last 5 years. And according to a U.S. State Department report, the Jamaican police is cited as the major perpetrator of unauthorized or extrajudicial killings in the Caribbean and Latin America. Last month, on July 9th and 10th, police killed 7 people in a 24-hour period. This in a country plagued by economic stagnation, poverty, and severe crime. Jamaica, it also should be noted, surpasses all other nations in the region except for Colombia in the number of civilian murders. Well, the problem of human rights abuses among Jamaica's police is further highlighted by the forced relocation of the homeless and the mentally ill. In July, police kidnapped 32 street people in the streets of Montego Bay and dumped them into a mud lake 50 miles away from the popular resort area. The incident, which caused public outrage, has led to no arrests. We go now to Jamaica to Lloyd D'Aguilar, who is a freelance journalist. Welcome to Democracy Now, Lloyd.
Welcome. Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you tell us about this, the number of killings that we're talking about here by police?
Well, I think you're pretty accurate in terms of the average number of people being killed by the police each year. In the 1980s, I remember an astounding figure of over 300 people being killed during that time. And it was said that on a per capita basis, more people were killed here than were killed in South Africa, where a civil war was in progress. So it's a very, very serious issue.
Well, can you talk about the underlying economic issues, how people are responding to the killings? Is there a movement like there is growing in the United States?
Well, the police department has put into effect what they're calling Operation Intrepid to recover guns that exist in inner-city communities. But people are opposed to this Operation Intrepid because it's exacerbating the police killings, because it gives the police license to enter into people's homes, to declare roadblocks. And as a result, it has contributed to more lawlessness on the part of the police, because the very thin legal restrictions that exist against them at this moment have been removed, so that they are now a law unto themselves in these inner city communities. Recently, they had a roadblock in one community, and a man of unsound mind attempted to cross the roadblock that they had set up, and they simply beat him to death. And since that has happened, the government has said nothing. The police high command have said nothing. They have gone into communities and they have scraped people up. They have put them in trucks, taken them to police centers, fingerprinted and photographed them illegally, because unless you're charged with a crime, you're not supposed to be photographed and fingerprinted. Whenever these things happen, people in the communities, they usually block the roads, they burn tires, and they protest. But what the government does is to simply wait them out, allow them to vent their frustrations, and then nothing happens. And the police, when they execute, they always claim that the criminals, the alleged criminals, shoot first, and then they respond. And in almost all the cases, the people who shoot first are killed. But very few policemen are ever killed in these circumstances. So it leads one to see very clearly that it's a tissue of lies that the police give out whenever they execute people. You mentioned the 7 people being killed in a 24-hour period. In one incident, the police simply surrounded a house where they suspected gunmen to be and went in and executed them. You know, they made claims of there being a gunfight, but all evidence indicates that there was no gunfight. These people were executed. The other three people were simply taken out of a car and shot. Again, they claim that the people shot at them. Only one gun was recovered, they say, and nothing has been done about that. So there is a culture of the government tolerating police execution as a policy to try and control crime.
Lloyd Aguilar, we just mentioned this issue of the homeless and mentally ill being dumped from the streets of the popular resort area of Montego Bay in a mud lake 50 miles away. What's a mud lake and what happened
actually,
to them?
Well, actually, Amy, they weren't dumped in the mud lake. They were dumped near the mud lake. You know, there's a difference there. But 32 people were dumped near the mud lake, and it is suspected that some of them may have died. No one knows for sure. But what is happening where that is concerned, it is suspected that the business leaders, the tourist leader, the leaders of tourism in Montego Bay got together with the police and decided that these street people, some of them of mentally ill, were an embarrassment to the tourism industry there. And so they decided that they would get rid of them. And in the middle of the night, I understand that the plan was to get rid of them two by two. But the police who were leading that operation decided that they didn't have time to go for them two by two. So they just simply scraped them up off the streets, put them in a truck, tie them up, spray them with all kind of pepper spray and things of that nature, and took them away in the dead of the night and dumped them near this mud lake, hoping perhaps that some of them might have gone into the mud lake and die. A mud lake is really the bauxite companies, you know, their waste material. They dump this in what they call a mud lake. So it's really bauxite, waste material that have accumulated in a lake. And of course, that is also an environmental problem. To date, nothing has happened to anybody. Nobody has been indicted. Nobody has been arrested. The government, the police have done a very sloppy investigation of the incident. It is claimed that a lot of money has been spent on this operation and to buy people's silence. And the government has taken no political responsibility for it. It has done nothing politically to make people believe that they are really serious, that is an abuse of people's human rights. And a lot of people are very upset. I believe that the middle class here, some members of the middle class, are beginning to respond. And so civic organizations are being formed, civic organizations focusing on human rights.
Well,
and I believe that some interesting things will happen in the weeks and maybe months to come.
And we will follow them up. I want to thank you very much, Lloyd Aguilar, for joining us, freelance journalist based in Jamaica, which has the highest level of police killings in the Caribbean. That does it for today's show. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, 1-800-735-0230 is the number to call. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Bernard White is our engineer, and we'd like to hear from you. Our email address, democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!